Welcome back to the Poker Player Podcast. I'm your host, Andres Furley, and today I'm joined by a guest who went from struggling in makeup in the online games and then later on also some in the live games to some of the biggest stakes or the highest stakes in Macau or some of the highest stakes in Macau, making over $1 million in profit. And then when the pandemic hit, he went on to telling the story on YouTube, going viral, getting like about 60K views because a lot of people loved your story. Welcome to the podcast, Change Poker.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today? And maybe you can tell the story a little bit better than me. Give us a little bit of the clips about what that was about and how, why you think that it went viral on YouTube.
Well, it's interesting. So you've kind of summed it up really. Started playing poker, was a struggling poker player. I was probably just very comfortable playing poker, just making my $2,000 to $3,000 a month, living in Thailand, living a good life. And then obviously, I don't know if you've heard this part of the story, but I ended up going to jail in Thailand, and that was kind of like a reality check. I was like, oh, okay, well, you could, you know, just let all this go, or you could actually try and do this poker thing. And then tried a bit harder. And, you know, poker is one of those things where it's exponential. Like, as you get better at it, the more money you can make and that kind of side of it. Ended up playing on some apps, did okay on the apps, then dusted like $100,000 back. That was pretty stressful, but my backer was nice enough to let me play online for myself to make some money and improve at poker. And then Macau kind of just came out of nowhere, and he had been staking slash buying action in some players there. And he's like, oh, why don't you try that? And that just went really, really well from day one. I think ended up winning like over the course of 2019 about just over £1 million. So whatever that is in dollars these days, I don't know the exchange rates. but that was obviously getting out of makeup and then starting off with about 60% of my action. And then as it got higher stakes, didn't quite have all my action. So it's not to say that I've got £1 million in the bank by any means, but it was you know, at least halfway there. And so that was great. And then the pandemic hit and it was kind of like, all right, went to Thailand to chill out for a little bit to see what happened. And then didn't seem to go away. Macau didn't seem to want to reopen again. And then it was like, what do I do now? My friend's like, why don't you stream? And I was like, why? And just ended up doing it for fun, boredom, something to do, because it was quite hard to motivate yourself to play sort of reasonably low stakes poker when you played significantly high stakes. And I had some £200,000 months in Macau. I had three of them, and it was just like, you know, comparing that to like trying really, really hard in like some of the hardest games online and having a 20K month just doesn't move the needle enough for you to like want to put the effort in to be able to do that, or at least for me. And maybe that was me being lazy at the time, but especially when I just wanted to like, oh, I've got money now, I want to enjoy it. And it was like, well, I can't really do anything because of the pandemic. So I was kind of pushed into streaming, and then people seem to resonate with my journey a little bit. And I think that's kind of maybe why people followed it along. I think people, people get into poker because they see themselves getting to the top, and that's what they want. And you know, I did it, you know, I put through the grind, you know, and I feel like I don't come across as like a nerdy solver guy. I come across as like a guy that like, you know, from Birmingham, England, who just like struggled through it and just figured it out on his own. And I think that resonates with people because they want to think that they can do that too. And I think they can. And I think that's why maybe the story resonates a bit more with people.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I think that was relatable. They saw something in that story that could happen, or, you know, they think could happen for themselves, or they want at least that to happen. I think that was very relatable, that they could go from you know, a job that they sometimes maybe liked and sometimes didn't. Like you talked a little bit about a few jobs, and some of them you had like an argument with a boss, but some of the other ones you also enjoyed, right? But then money wise, it didn't really pay off compared to what poker could bring you.
Yeah, I've had a fair few jobs. When I was 15, I ran some music events that got me some cash. And then I ended up working at McDonald's when I was 16. I actually loved working at McDonald's. It was actually really cool because no one takes it too seriously. It was all just students and people similar ages working there by some of the managers that were very chill. And then went to university. I was a poker dealer for a while in a casino when I was at university. Horrible hours, but reasonable good money when I'm a student. But working in a casino in England is probably one of the worst places you can deal, because There's no tipping culture there. It's basically minimum wage, it's unsociable hours. And honestly, people dealing to people in casinos are some of the worst people you can deal with. I'd rather, yeah, okay. People say that you should never work in like customer service. Like being a poker dealer is one of the worst things you can do because you get some absolutely horrible people that you need to deal with. One of my biggest pet hates in live poker is people treating the dealer badly, probably because of that experience. Then ended up leaving that whilst I was at uni because just the focus a bit more on uni. And I started to make a little bit of money playing poker, but nothing too serious. After university, it was like, all right, take any job I could get. I started off at William Hill. Then I left that because I was still kind of making a little bit more money at poker than I was doing William Hill. Then poker didn't work out so well. And then I ended up going to work in a Wetherspoons, which is like a pretty famous pub chain in England, in the kitchen. Hated that. Then ended up going to London as a recruitment consultant. Still couldn't afford to live really on a recruitment consultant salary in London. And I was like, right, I might as well just be a poker dealer in England again and live at home. Ended up becoming a recruitment consultant in England, which was, to be fair, not that bad because I got the similar money that I did in London, but I got to live at home. So all my expenses were just like slashed. And then I just looked for jobs that were like reasonable graduate level jobs. Ended up getting a pretty good job as an operations consultant. And everyone that worked there went to Oxford or Cambridge. You had to pass a test to get in, which suited me a lot more than all the other kind of stuff because I felt like that's where my edge was, if that's such a thing. And that was a pretty intense, like, but then I just realized that, okay, I'm getting my 40K a year package, which was really good as a graduate. 5K of that goes towards your car. X amount was going towards your bonus. And then, so realistically, I was picking up like £1,800 a month. And eventually I think every like year I get like a 4K bonus, which was nice. But then, you know, after you pay your rent and after you pay your student loan and after you pay bits and bobs for your car, you've got say £1,800 a month left. Mm-hmm. And you're literally like, oh, I can do all these things. You can't really do anything. Like you've got overdrafts from university. So, okay, maybe some of that gets cleared up and then you've got no money. Or you can maybe go play a little bit of poker or you can go do something. But then you're absolutely knackered because you're just working full time all the time. It was literally, for one of my projects there, I would have to wake up at, say, 5 o'clock in the morning on a Monday, fly up to Scotland, and I'd be in a hotel all week and then fly back on Friday. And then you'd be so tired from the week that you just wouldn't want to do anything with your weekends. I was like, why am I doing this? Like, I'd much rather play poker for less money than do that. And as much as they would sell you the progression and like, oh, one day you'd be making 100K a year. And then you do all the numbers and you do all the tax numbers. You're like, okay. So that goes from like £1,800 to like, okay, £3,000 in 10 years time. And I'm like, oh, could have worked 10 years. So I've got £2,000 in the bank instead of 1,000. And then I just couldn't make sense of that. And it just, so for me, I was like, right, well, I'd rather play poker. So then I was like, right, I've got to do this poker thing again. And it was a bit more of a fire in my belly to do that. Moved out of home because I just felt like that was the right thing to do. I was sick of living at home. It was fine when I was working away a week, but then full-time wasn't really going to work. Then my friend invited me out to Thailand. He'd been on a trip to Thailand before and he ended up just like staying and I went to visit him and I was like, yeah, that was fun. And then my other friend was going to visit him. I was like, what am I doing in the UK? Like I can make the same amount of money and just do this in Thailand. And it was great. I was just making my £1,500 to £2,000 a month playing poker. And I was probably better than that, but I was happy with that. I was happy, content making my $2,000, $3,000 a month. And then someone suggested me joining a CFP, which became Bitbee Cash, but it wasn't that at the time. It did turn into that. And I was like the first student with the first coach. And again, I was probably better than 100 Zoom at the time, but that's what I was comfortable playing and in Thailand. And then I ended up moving up to 200 Zoom with the coaching. And then just went on a huge heater, went up to 400 Zoom. And in the first 3 months, I made like 45K. I had to give half away, but 22,000, that's the most money I've ever had in my bank account. I was like, wow, this is sick. Flew my parents out to Thailand to come visit me. And I was like, yeah, this is what freedom's all about. Like, it doesn't matter if I have to go home and I lose my money playing poker. I'd rather just be on this adventure now. And if I have to go back and go back to that job in Birmingham, then that's fine because I'd rather just enjoy these 5 years and not have that as a barrier to me enjoying it. Then I want to use Downswing. My relationship with the coach kind of broke down. He had some issues himself. And that ended up, the deal kind of finished. And then I picked up some staking on some app games, spun some money there, then ended up going to jail. And then it was just like, right, back to where I was. you know, you've wasted this kind of opportunity. You've made like $45,000 in 3 months, and then the next year you're back in England and you've got to start again. And I think that going back home and having to start again and realizing a little more what I wanted, not out of life at the time at least. And then it was like, right, put your head down, get back over there. I had another friend that was going back at the time. I had about £7,000 to my name. Just went to Thailand, really grinded. And then over the next year, spun that up to like 36,000, but like with my expenses too, though. So I was making more than that. I was getting involved in some more coaching and like trying to make money that way. And then by the end of that, that's when I was like, okay, I'm ready to go and start taking some Macau stuff with some staking. That went well. Started off selling a lot of action and then gradually bought more of my own action. And then gradually went, right, Macau this year, that's what's going to be. Ended up in Macau. And that's basically my poker journey with jobs in between, start to finish.
That Macau transition, I think, is really interesting. Like how, so somebody just told you, you know what, I'll stake you for these games. They're kind of good games there. And then all of a sudden you increased your own share, right? That what you had in those games. How did you transition so quickly from online poker to, I'm sure it's the same game, right? From online poker to live poker.
It is the same game, but there's obviously a nuance to the difference between the two. But I would say that I've always been a bit of a hybrid. I've never been a pure online player or a pure live player. Like when I was originally starting in poker, it was all live. Like I never started online. I was like one of those guys, I can't win online. And then moving to Thailand and like having to like, I realized that playing live poker just wasn't going to be feasible if I wanted that freedom. So tournaments wasn't really for me and live poker wasn't really for me because I wanted to live in Thailand and I wanted to play online and I wanted to be able to have the freedom to do whatever I wanted. So that's why I kind of had to make online cash games work. So for me, switching back to live was almost quite easy in a way because I wasn't one of these guys that just only spent time playing online. I'd come from that live background, even though it was low stakes, but that's enough to get a feel for how live players work because you're playing against a fish. That is basically the same. It doesn't matter that like all the other guys are X. That's what your online stuff's for. But the fish, that's what your live stuff's for, regardless of what stake it was, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and how was then, basically you wanted to live in Thailand and then want to be free and have the freedom to do whatever you want to do. But how is... can you describe a little bit how living in Thailand was, especially now also with the jail story that at some point, maybe go a little bit into that and how would you recommend that for anyone like giving it a shot? Is Thailand like the GTO place to be?
It's a good question. So coming to Thailand for me, so first of all, I was a chubby, overweight ginger guy with no social skills and had a few friends here. And it's cheaper here. So I'm going from, say, paying in London, I was paying like £550 a month rent in zone 4, which if you don't know zones in London, like the middle is zone 1. Okay. Yeah. So basically imagine like the center is like zone 1 and then a perimeter around that is zone 2. So zone 4 is really far away. So zone 4, you're talking £250 a month and just transport just to get into the center. So it's ridiculous already. Versus living in the middle of a city of Bangkok for £400 a month basically with your bills, and then if you're splashing on food, like realistically you could live in the center of Bangkok, have a good time for £1,000 a month, which is what I was splashing on rent in London. So that was great for me. What I personally liked was I'm a bit of a night owl anyway, so going out at nighttime, it was warm, it's not cold like it's in England. I could walk around in my shorts and t-shirt all the time, and there's this vibe in the UK at the moment where in a lot of westernized countries where it's a lot more regulated. You know, if you go to a club and the bouncer doesn't like the look of you and he's like, oh, you haven't dressed the right way, or you're a bit too drunk, he's decided he's had a bad day, you're not coming in, that just doesn't happen here. Like there's a little bit of give and take in terms of like there's a few weird laws and like if you get on the wrong side of the police and all that kind of stuff, but that's very, very avoidable. That's not like something that you need to worry about. I'll talk about a bit more about my situation in a minute, but in terms of like that being a reason not to come, it really isn't. But yeah, so now I'm in a place now called Rawai, which is in Phuket, which is in the south of Thailand. And Phuket's an island, and Rawai is a really, really nice place. You're right next to two really nice beaches, a big lake. So I go walk around the lake now every day. I get out. There's loads of nice restaurants, coffee shops, French restaurants, nice places to eat steak, which is my favorite food. I like Thai food too. Loads of nice. To be fair, the Thai food's better elsewhere, but the Thai food here is okay. And so you've got all your creature comforts, being able to like get around. Like I rent a Jeep now, so I can just get around everywhere. I can drive around the island. I've got my beach, which I'm not really into the beach, but I just like being near sort of like the sea, even though I don't really love the beach that much. But if I want to go to the beach, I can. Nighttime, it's warm. Restaurants are good. And everything's way cheaper. Like, it's hard for me to justify go to the UK. It's just like, the only thing for me in the UK is my family, which I do miss. But now, without trying to sound arrogant, I just fly my family to me, right? And like, my family like seeing the rest of the world too. So like, if they're gonna go on a holiday, why don't you come to Thailand? And like, that's what I've been able to do for them. Like, I took all my family to the Aussie Millions in 2020, which was like a great family trip. But like, to go into a little bit more about my jail story, that was completely avoidable. And just, you just need to be a little bit more wet behind the ears, I guess. But essentially what happened was, we're playing poker. So online poker, gambling is illegal in Thailand, but is poker gambling? That's a gray area. We're not going to push these gray areas. We're just going to play poker in private, in our rooms, and not mention it. And you're going to be fine doing that. Don't play in a coffee shop or do something stupid like that. Just play privately and you won't have an issue. So a friend of ours gets into an argument with his girlfriend. Girlfriend storms to our place, thinks he's there. He's not. We're like, he's not here. She gets upset. She goes away. Next thing you know, we get a knock at the door. We say, come in. We go and answer the door. Turns out to the police. I think that she's been shouting her mouth off in the corridor at him down the phone, maybe leaving a voicemail. And the police say, oh, we're here to investigate a disturbance. And I'm like, well, there's no one here. There's no problems here. Like, come and have a look. No problem. Comes inside. I forget that my friend smokes weed. He's got a bag of weed in his drawer in his room. It just escalates from there. We end up in a holding cell for 2 days and then get bailed out, end up going to court and paying like a 2,500 baht fine for me, 3,000 baht for him, which
that
is
hilarious.
Yeah, $55 or yeah. $55 to $75 or whatever that works out to be. But the stress of the situation is significantly more than all of that, right? It's super scary and stressful, but...
When I listened to that story, I was like, also that sounded so completely insane to me. Like having to go through all that stress, like being arrested, which would just like, I was born in Switzerland. It's like, okay, yeah. Unless you do some really dumb shit, that would just never happen. And right. And then you know, going to hearing that from a place like Thailand, you know, foreign country. And then in the end, it actually being just about $55. I was like,
mad, isn't it?
Madness, absolute madness. Yeah. You know, it's like they could have just said, you know, if you wanted money, you could have just said so from the beginning, right?
The thing is, if you pay the police as it would have been, it would have been significantly more than that. When you actually do go through the court system,
okay,
the courts are not quote unquote corrupt. It's before it gets to the court that to stop you getting to the court. That is the part to pay, but we just didn't see the opportunity, or we didn't understand the process, and we didn't know what to do. So that ended up just going too far on the system that we were like, oh, too late now, we're going to court.
What could you have done? Like not bribing the police, right? But what could you have done to go quicker to court?
You couldn't do anything to go quicker to court once you're that far in the system. But the thing I would have done is offer to pay a fine, and worded it very carefully that way, as opposed to waiting to see what happened. I would have been a bit more forthright and a bit more, okay, I pay the fine, I'm sorry. And I would have been way better. Also, you gotta be careful. Also, like, the longer you live here, the more you meet Thai people, the more like, the more you know Thai policemen, and the more you know, like, literally, I've got friends here, or friends of friends, and this is gonna make me sound like I'm connected, I'm not. It's just gonna be like, oh, I've got a slight issue here. Could you call so-and-so and sort this out? And then it'd just be like, he calls him, you get a phone call back, give him 5,000 baht, go away. All right, fine. And then but that you get here through being here a long time. And like, you know, that, you know, even that's not perfect, but like, I've got a friend who loves it here. He's from Australia and he thinks Australia is getting like super, super regulated now. Like he just doesn't like it. Like the fact that he just, you know, he doesn't go out very often, but when he goes out, he's like, I just want to be able to like go out, get as drunk as I want to, not have anyone judge me, put the music on, whatever I do, what I want to do. And like, if you drive drunk in Thailand, no, I'm not condoning that you drive drunk, but it's just, you pay your fine, or you're not going to get arrested, or like this, you know, there's levels of corruption where he's almost okay with it. Because like, I'd rather just, you know, I'd rather, Australia's corrupt in some ways, but they just hide it better. For he goes, for example, like he tried to get his Thai wife to Australia and it's cost him like hundreds of thousands of US to try and sort out the visa because it's like really, really hard to do. But here, you just slip someone like 10,000 baht. You know, and it can be done. It's like sometimes corruption is a good thing, but like it's because you can just grease the right palms and get what you want done. Whereas in Australia, you can do that if you're super rich, and they don't make it obvious, but it's still there, mm-hmm. in his opinion. And so like
it just scales to a completely different number. And I mean, regulation, yeah. International regulation, and laws are like very, very interesting. There's just infinite amounts of things to consider. And I think as a poker player, we kind of have a little bit of different perspective because we consider at least once we're single, like if we were in a relationship and you know, our significant other would want to stay somewhere, then it gets kind of problematic. Or if you have kids, you know, it's a lot different. But if you're single, then, you know, you can consider any place, right?
Really good YouTube channel that I recommend to anyone interested in this called Nomad Capitalist. And I've only just recently found them, and they specialize in more business guys that have got, say, 1 million to 10 million net worth that want to operate in different countries, mainly for tax reasons. But there's, you know, you're not just going to move to the middle of nowhere to not pay any tax. Like if you've got a family, you might want to pay 5% tax, but then live in a place where there's good schools. Or you might want to live in this country for 3 months because it's nice and warm, and you might want to move to that. And there's like obviously loads of different options, loads of different visa options. Like some countries you can invest, you can get an investment visa. Some countries you don't need a visa because you can just stay there for the 3 months. Some countries you can do this tax option. Sometimes your business works this way, so there's this. But that's really interesting because like even he's like, well, you know, no one wants, you know, there's different things for everyone, what they want, whether you, like you just said, like you've got kids or you're in a relationship or you're single or you're a poker player or blah, blah, blah. Because like the tax thing for us is less relevant because most places we're not going to have to do it because we're just going to live internationally or get self-paid out in Bitcoin or whatever we want to do. But, you know, so that's less of a factor. So that's great. So that means even more countries are open to us because if we go to New Zealand, we're not paying any tax there. And whereas other people, they're going to have to pay tax on their earnings and all that kind of stuff. So it's actually really interesting. And I think that's one of the places where competition truly is global. Like, you know, when we're talking about taxing businesses at like a really high rate and they're just literally, oh, we're just going to go to the British Virgin Islands, so up to you, buddy. If you want to charge us really high tax, you're gonna have to give us a reason for it. And that's going to happen more and more in the future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of changes coming on. And I also saw that channel Nomad Capitalist and how, you know, he found a really great business opportunity of knowing as much as possible about the world and where the benefits are for people depending on what they actually want, to basically find their optimum, right? And it's a very complex thing. And in the end, I guess, you just try to weigh up whatever you want out of life and whether it's actually worth it.
It's not the same for everyone. Yeah. It's not just like everyone come to Thailand now, it's great. Because realistically, I really like Thailand. I've got two properties here. I bought the properties because it's just opportunity, right? Like it's COVID and like, everything's down or whatever. But realistically, was that the right place for me to do? Like realistically, if I was working with this guy, maybe it wasn't. Maybe Cambodia was a spot. Like if I'm just trying to make the best ROI, and like maybe that was a bit of a mistake for me. But you know, the more you know, the better.
Yeah. And in 2019, when you went into the Macau Games, you basically, as you said, you increased your own share time by time, but then you also had 200K months. So what was that experience like all of a sudden going from, 50, 100K roll and then increasing your net worth and then all of a sudden actually have a lot of money? Like what was the experience like and what do you think about that?
So it was interesting because I'm a little bit of a psychopath when it comes to money. Like the difference between me having £50,000 and me having, say, £300,000, it's not much. It's not like I'm going to go and like buy a house or something. Like it just doesn't change much about me. I'm just, all right, I can survive a few more months. And that's something that I'm really starting to think about more and more now. I remember I had my first big month and I remember my bank account on paper was technically supposed to, I was still waiting to get paid, technically supposed to have like £250,000. And that was like, whoa, like that's big. Like you should go and enjoy this. And I took the month off and I went back to Thailand. I was like, this was in 2019. I went back to Thailand in October. I had no friends in Thailand bar one. And he was like, I don't really have that much money at the moment. I was like, don't worry. I'm going to pay for everything this week. I'm going to have a great night. And I spent as much money as I could. We went to all the bars we could. We're getting bottles everywhere. But like we drank a lot. But like the thing is, again, in Thailand, if you drink, like say you buy a bottle of Jack Daniels in a bar, you drink half. You go back the next day and get the other half. Like, so it wasn't like we were like, you're not even like, we're not wasting any bottles. We're going crazy. We're going to even the Russian strip clubs, which are like the expensive ones. And I spent £2,500 that week. And I really tried hard to spend it. Like I wasn't going like mental, but like yeah, I was only drinking. But like,
it's just not the place to spend it.
Yeah, I was just like, it's not like it's too much money. I know that's like sounds really arrogant, but like, it just, I don't know, it just never quite hits home. Like you just, if anything, you're a bit like, oh, I've got to protect this. I've got to be careful with this. I don't just want to like dust this now.
I would argue actually that that's not necessarily something out of the ordinary. I think the obviously a lot of people in this world have incentives for us to believe that once we get some money that we have to spend it, right? Advertisers are like trying to sell us this idea. And I would argue that actually most people who don't subject to this idea, or maybe half, I don't know what the number is, yeah, they would react in a very similar way and say, yeah, it actually doesn't change you. Like some people it does change. And then they just punt all the money on cars and on like buying houses in expensive places. And then, you know, quite naturally going broke again. There's also obviously sports stars who went on to be millionaires. And then once their career finished, because of their exorbitant lifestyles, they would again go broke and just go to that equilibrium, right, where they saw themselves. Because the view that they had of themselves is as someone who actually spends all the money and just has like roughly the network. So the equilibrium went back to where they were at before they went on to become one of the best basketball players and making millions. So that's actually really interesting how different characters react to this, you know, new gains wealth. And you're one of them who tried to spend, but in a place where it was actually a little expensive. But what would you think would have happened if you were in somewhere like Vegas? Because there, they could have easily taken 100K for all kinds of services, right? Let's not kid ourselves.
I mean, like for me, I'm never gonna like waste it on a car. I've never really owned a car. Sure. I've had cars, but like I've rent this one now. Like even that, I'm like thinking, maybe having a car would be nice, but I'm just never in the same place long enough to justify having a car. I've tried to be really careful. Like I bought properties, but they're again investments. I don't even feel like I'm obviously spending liquid cash, but realistically, I'm hoping to get more cash from that in the future. And then I was like, realistically, I want to invest more in myself. And that's when I was like, right, well, let's figure out some like actual numbers here to like grow the percentage I've got. So I used my bankroll to then basically benchmark what piece I bought in the game. So that's what I was doing. And then I was like, well, that worked out well. So I ended up with more money. And I was just like, okay, I'll invest some money as well. So like, but then I didn't understand enough about investing. I made a bit of a punt. I invested in Tesla at a very good price. I made a lot of money on Tesla, but I didn't do it with an ISA. And an ISA is what the UK version is of like a tax-free investment. So So for example, like you're allowed to make £12,000, I think, per year, tax-free. Tesla went really well. So now I have to sell it really slowly to order to like not pay taxes on it, which is not in the world to pay tax, but it's just not optimal to sell all of it right now if I wanted to. But if I'd known about ISAs, I would have got X like 100, 200K, 150K, whatever, tax-free. But like I'm just a fish. Like there's no like financial advisor for poker players. We're just like, we don't really know what we're doing with money. And I actually think that investing in something like that is actually really valuable, because I kept asking all the people around me questions. But similar to the sports stars you mentioned, a lot of these guys are at the high stakes. They've been there for a while, see themselves as the sports stars. They want to go out every night and spend £1,000 a night out. I mean, the first time I spent £1,000 a night out, and I was just like, what have I done? Like there's a, you can buy a lady drink in a club in Macau, and it comes out like a Ferris wheel full of shots, and it's £100. And I'm just like, and what I think I was convinced to buy like seven of them. Plus I picked up the tab, and then I was just like, I've just spent £1,000 on a night out. That is absurd. Like I can't even imagine in Vegas what I go out with my friends. Maybe I tune into a ticket. Yeah. I still can't justify buying a table in Vegas. I just can't get there. Maybe there's loads of us, and it was like a one-off big treat and everyone was going to do it. So you got like, I don't know, like maybe you got like 10 years in like one of those like 15K booths and you're flicking like $1,500 or whatever. But even then it's just like,
I'm quite nitty with kind of stuff. Like I was, that was, I think, in 2013. And back then, I didn't even have a poker roll or whatever. Like, it was before I first cashed like 30K in like two tournaments. So back then, I was like vlogging for someone with a group. And this group one night decided to go out and have like bottle service. And like, and they told me the next night, I was like, okay, I'm actually happy I wasn't there. It was like 2.5K for like seven people for two bottles. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
two
are you bottles? Serious?
Right, yeah. Are you serious? Like, yeah. What's the point? Like, I, you know, pretty much, you know, you could have done or have a similar experience with friends, you know, back home in Switzerland. You know, when I was like 20, I was going out drinking, and that was like the time to do it, right? When I was like 20, and now, you know, I have other things to do, and sure, I'll go out again, but it's not going to add on any additional value having that experience. I think it's not.
Oh, I get it. Every now and again, like you go to Vegas, you're there for a few weeks, you're with some friends, you want to go and have a good night, you splurge a little bit. I'm not like saying don't have a good time, but then it's just like the value point just doesn't go away. Do you know the difference between being middle class and upper class?
Well, what do you think?
Well, someone said it to me once. He said that the difference between being middle class and upper class is, like, first of all, you can't ever be upper class if you are born middle class. And middle class, the best example he can give you is, let's say you go and buy a yacht, and the middle class person goes up and goes, right, how much is this yacht? How much is that yacht? Which one's better? Blah, blah, blah. Figures it out, buys the yacht. Upper class person goes, right, how much are these yachts? I'll have both. And they don't think about it. They just buy both. That's the difference. But a middle-class person will never stop being a middle-class person. You'll always still have that
mindset. The mindset, you think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. That your you know, mindset towards money, that's not going to change that easily, right? Your values, and they're not going to change that quickly. And how, like, your whole childhood and how you were raised, that has just a great influence on how you're going to behave monetarily with a lot of things, right? And it certainly has for me. Yeah,
I think I was also quite lucky that it was a bit of a grind to get to where I was. Yeah, it was exponential towards the end. And I always tell people, like, it's very hard to think exponentially because humans tend to think linearly. But, you know, there's a few opportunities early on in my career where I could have banked a big tournament. And that, you know, maybe I wasn't ready to win that money then. Maybe now that I'm there, like, I'm mature enough to, like, realize that I can't handle it, or realize that I have to be smart with it, or whatever it is. Whereas, like, if I just binked the tournament for 50K, I would have thought, yeah, you know what? Tournaments are easy. I'm just going to play 10 of these every
day. Exactly. That's how it goes. So you got the ball rolling in Macau, and then all of a sudden the pandemic starts.
Yeah.
Like, and then you're, okay, now I cannot continue printing. Like, what's this? And what were your thoughts?
Well, first of all, it was nice to take a breather and be like, right. Because Macau is not healthy. You're and I was probably about 120 kilos at my peak. Okay. And I took the time to, like, focus a bit more on myself. And I was lazy. I rewatched the whole of Breaking Bad for a little bit. And I was a bit like, right, just kind of wait this out, see what's going on. And I was quite like, what's the word? Like, just did really do anything. Was completely just a non-person, if anything. And I was just like, okay, what do I want to do? And I figured that I wanted to invest more in poker. So I probably doubled down on my horses, on my one horse at the time. I was like, all right, you should start playing bigger and better, and like, let's concentrate on you for a little bit. And then I was like, well, I don't really, like, the thing is, I've come to the understanding, I don't really like having horses. The stress of them winning or losing is bigger than the stress of me winning or losing. I don't know why. I care more about their results than I care about my own.
You have no control, right? You have no control.
Yeah, it's just different. I'm like, come on, win. And whereas I'm playing, I'm obviously, it's completely different. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm comfortable or whatever. But with horses, it just feels different, especially when you're, like, more emotionally attached. My mom, dad, and brother all play. And, like, if they're on a final table, it's, like, so stressful. If I'm on a final table, I'm like, yeah, whatever, final table, play, see what happens. If I'm playing a massive game with 100K pot, I'm like, I've got to go all in now as a block. But, like, my brother's on the table. I'm like, Jesus Christ, Brandon, please get this through. So then it was kind of like just sheer boredom. And then my friends, like, suggested I stream. So I just bought a mic, I set up, and I just started doing it a little bit. And then for me, challenging myself a little bit at 500 Zoom was, like, more interesting than playing, like, looking for, like, other stakes. Mm-hmm. And then that went well with the audience that wanted to watch me on Twitch as well. Then I just hired the same guy that did the Twitch overlays to do the highlights for YouTube. did a little vlog to say, oh, this is me, which is the one that you referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of took off. And I don't really remember putting that much effort into it or that doing that much. I kind of just still stream whenever I feel like it. I don't really have a schedule. I kind of just do it off and on. And it just kind of escalated. And it was just like something to do, if anything. And then it's kind of nice when you're not doing anything to have something that makes you feel like it's a little bit productive. I did kind of slow down a bit because I was like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I streaming? It seems like people want me to do it, but like, there's no like end goal here. Like before it was like making money. This isn't really making money. This is kind of like semi-entertainment, semi-educational, semi kind of like just something to do. And it was quite fun because I was like, I felt like I was getting sharper at poker the more I played and stuff. And like playing Fire Resume obviously does keep you sharp as well, even if you're breaking even / winning small. So that was cool. And then people were just asking me for like material. And I was like, well, I basically just say everything in my head when I'm playing. So like realistically, you could just watch me and that's enough. But then more and more I realized, and I've realized this what I've done in my poker journey in the past, is I've always tried to, when I've coached people, I've always tried to coach them to be as good as me at poker. And the reason I do that is because once they get to my level, or at least equivalent or whatever that is, they can help me get better. So I like being in this like collaborative state as opposed to like no, I'm better than you now. It's not even that I'm better than them. It's like, I think this about this and I want you to understand why I think that. And then when you can get to the point where you can challenge that and then you can help me get that even better, like I embrace that. So then it was like, well, all the peers that I'm hanging around with now aren't at my level financially. So, and they aren't at my level like freeing wise, but, and I don't know what to do with myself now. So it's like, if I can get other people to that, then they can teach me what to do next. So that was kind of like the reason I ended up starting the academy. It wasn't necessarily just because of the demand. It was much more because of the, I want people to have the freedom that I've got, because like you say, I can't, am I going back to a real job now? Like I just, you know, and what am I going to be qualified to do? And it's, you know, it's tough for poker players out there. And like, realistically, people are in the jobs that I was in and people want to break out and learn poker. It might not even be poker. It might be something else they learn to do. But this sort of like freedom, this lifestyle, a lot of people want that. And if I can help them get there, then that's fantastic.
Sure. And I think also the whole point, like, it's quite natural that when you coach people that some of them are going to become better than you. Like, unless you're like one of the top high stakes coaches, and you're at the very top, that's naturally going to happen. And I also knew that, like, coaching some people and, you know, maybe with some of them, you can only, like, where they are at right now, you can help them a little bit. You can help them see something about their game. And that's the whole point. And then, you know, they move on and then overtake you in skill. And hopefully that, you know,
maybe with them,
you will learn something from them in return, you know? Yeah, and with some others, they will obviously never get to where you are because they also, you know, maybe they actually don't want to buy the coaching, but what they want to buy is like the, you know, that they've done something, that they've tried their best, that they want to buy the, you know, the pill to success. But that's not what it's about, because in the end, you have to do your own work. And
we have a big performance side of the academy, which is like probably the most undersold part, where then when people come in, they're like, oh shit, like that's you know, you think you're getting like a poker course, but you're getting like a life lesson that has poker in it. That's the best way to explain it. I've tried to explain it to people, but they don't quite get it until they see it and they're like, oh.
I think there's a lot of things to be learned about to be a poker player as well, and to think as, you know, in this gambling industry, what's your best course of action? Like you said, you know, your journey is the best proof for it. You know, you were somewhere and then it was an exponential thing in Macau. Yeah. It wasn't just a linear thing and the grind, but all of a sudden you found this one game where you got staked at first, but then you increased your own piece. And then all of a sudden your, you know, winnings were exponential. And I think that's something we can't realize before we get there. And I'm also trying to think, well, you know, there's this two goals, right? One of them is becoming a lot better at your game. For me, it's Pop Limit, No More Fear, It's No Limit. And then the other one is to find the best possible game where you can use that skill to actually win, you know, the most of it.
Well, I would take it one step further back. I would say your goal is to make money. And there's a combination of getting good enough and finding the game that's making the most money, and you're just constantly trying to solve that equation of which one's going to be right for you at the time. Like, some people are like, what should I play? And like, what is your goal? To improve or make money? Or it's always inevitably going to be a combination of both. Mm-hmm. So for me, playing Zoom is going to help you improve faster. But for example, if you're playing 100 Zoom, you could probably beat the 200 reg table. So that's where you're going to be to make more money. So if you want to start shot taking, or you got, mm-hmm. you've got 100 Zoom under control, now it's time to shot take. Don't shot take 200 Zoom. Shot take the 200 reg tables and look for other sites. And that's how you should increase your limits. And that's when you're like, all right, building my bankroll. Then you get your bankroll to play 200 Zoom. Then you're shot taking 200 Zoom and it's harder. And that's where you start improving again. And there's always that give and take and ebb and flow of which one's the right thing mm-hmm. to do. But some of the biggest lessons I've had are when I've been shot taking and be like, all right, I'm going to get my ass handed to me again. I remember one of my first shot takes of 500 Zoom, and I was like bluffing in a spot where I've got a lot of bluffs, and I got called, and I got hero called really wide, and I was getting really annoyed. And then the spot came up the other way. I was like, ah, this guy's going to have to bluff everything here, and I'm just going to get to call with this bluff catcher. And then I was like, ready for the spot, and I was like, here we go. And he just 3x pops me, and I was like, damn, that's what I'm supposed to do in that spot. And you just learn from that. You're like, that's a really cool way to like deal with the fact that you've got so many bluffs in this spot. You can just bet really big, and that's okay. And then that puts me in the spot again. I'm like, great, I got to do that turn to Zoom. Oh, that seems to work. And then refine that and learn about that. And that's how I've improved the fastest.
Yeah, a few years ago, this whole problematic as a poker player with like what games you can afford to play kind of hit me. I realized that I was actually on the roll. Like, but I don't know, I practice a little bit, tighter bankroll management than most people. That's just how my upbringing was. And I just can't have a risk of ruin. Like, even if it's like marginal, I want to eliminate that as much as possible. So, but I kind of realized looking at like some of the 25-50 live PLO games, like, yeah, I should actually be playing that, but I can't. Like, this is not responsible if I sit down now and just.
So why wouldn't you just sell some action if the game's better than what you're playing?
Because of hourly mostly. I thought that, some of the smaller games are going to be making me a better hourly than actually selling some of the action. I mean, quite realistically. So I just said, okay, like, I'm going to keep on grinding until I have the roll, and I'm going to go back and then play it then. And then, now years later, I think, I can sit down the next time I'm going to see the game. Maybe not the, the 100, 200 and stuff, but I can shot take very realistically and some of the bigger live games after the pandemics. I'm really happy that during the pandemic, I found a few games where I could increase the bankroll and continue the journey. And I think that in the end, I'm not even sure if that's what I want to be doing for like the next few years. I don't know. How about you? Like, after the pandemic, do you have like any number that you are, how do you see that? Are you going to see yourself a grind for the next 5-10 years?
I don't even see myself as a grind now. Mm-hmm. Pretty chill. And actually, it's an interesting question because I have a performance coach and he's been like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I don't know. It's tough because like you've got less freedom, obviously, during this pandemic. And it's not as easy as going, I'm just going to go to America and play live poker and see how I feel there because I want to enjoy that for a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more like you got to kind of like plan these things and figure it out. We've got the World Series coming up. So my only plans really is to try and figure out getting there. And then doing some more like live poker vlogging and that kind of stuff. Cause that stuff I enjoy. I've got my academy now, which is full steam ahead. I want that to be the best academy in poker. And I'm fairly confident that we're on the right track to doing that. Mm-hmm. That's just going to be a combination of getting the right people and the right team involved. And I think we've got a really good team now. And that's just like, hopefully.
Who are you working with like that in the academy, or what are the other coaches?
It's mainly me as the coach, and then it's my business partner who's the performance coach, and then we hire some other performance coaches that we've trained to deliver the style of performance coaching that we want, so that we can get that to more people rather than it just be so we can get smaller knit groups with the performance stuff. And then we've got one guy that is more of an admin, but he's a bit more than admin wouldn't be fair to say. That's going to be that was in the first academy and he's very much involved. And now we're looking and taking on someone to help us with. We've got a full-time editor now that helps with my videos and works for the academy. We've got a full-time marketer guy that we've just taken on to potentially like increase the way we do things. And we've got one of my original horses that does some of the hand review stuff that like, so they get to post hand reviews every day and then so rather than me be constantly on the Discord. So it's quite a reasonable sized team now. And it's a lot of mouths to feed, but obviously that just comes with like delivering like the product as well as we can and people being very happy with it and then them telling other people and then keeping that going. So on the back of that, then my performance coach, who's not in the academy, is looking to launch his own course in like nutrition, and he's like rated the best nutritionist in Europe. And I'm like, ah, I'm not sure what academies now. So it's becoming more of it could now grow horizontally as opposed to vertically and be more like a place to go to run academies. So that'd be pretty cool that we can get like all sorts of skills in here. And then, you know, if we could dream big, like if people choose to like join academies and learn about, like, say, even if they want to become a professional DJ or whatever the skill is that is monetizable for them, as opposed to like choosing other education, then that's pretty cool. And that might be part of the future.
How many people do you think across the board can realistically succeed with the outside help of either a coach, an academy, or any product like a course?
So it's very dependent on the person. There's a lot of people who I think you were kind of alluded to earlier, who I would call all the gear and no idea. So the kind of people that want to buy every single course, but it doesn't matter how many courses they buy, they're still not going to get there. And then there's the other kind of people that are going to make it regardless of whether they bought the course or not. And I think everyone ultimately is on a spectrum. And I think that what we're very good at is really getting down to the core of what these people are up to and calling them out. And like, we're not, there are some people that they don't like me in the first few weeks. Like, I can be pretty like dry and pretty like, you just need to fucking sort this out. Like, if you want to make money in this game. And we don't hold things back in terms of like, we're not nicey-nice to people. We're not just like, you'll be fine. Just watch the course and good luck to you. It's very much like, people aren't going to join my course unless they see people having good results in this course and people coming out the other side of it going, yeah, that was tough, but we had a good time. So I like to think that we're going to be as a higher percentage, but that's me being biased in terms of people joining and moving forward, because a lot more, it's less passive learning and a bit more like, do this now, do this now, do this now. Are you ready? Have you done that? Do this now. Have you done this? Are you doing this? What about this? We told you to do that. Why aren't you doing that? And so it's a little bit more, it's not handheld. It's almost like they're pushed through the fucking door. And I think some people need that approach and some people didn't realize they needed that approach. And so I don't know. To answer your question, I don't know. I like to think that whatever the percentage is, we can increase that with what we're doing.
Yeah, but
of course. It's hard to know. It's obviously ultimately down to the individual, which is a bit of a cop-out thing for an academy to say, but it really is.
And also, you actually got sponsored by GG Poker recently, and that's also another avenue that they go down. And so you have like a contract with them that, you know, you stream, you make content, you got people signing up to the site. How was that experience so far? And can you talk a little bit about that new thing?
Yeah, so they approached me probably like 6 months ago when I wasn't really sure what I was up to. Mm-hmm. And now obviously I'm going to have an academy and I'm going to be a bit more of an ambassador role in poker. It kind of made more sense because I knew what I wanted from them. And most of the things I wanted from them was like, help me grow my YouTube, help me do all this kind of stuff. So I am on the Twitch team, but ultimately I'm only on the Twitch team because there isn't anywhere else to put me. They would have made me into a like standalone YouTube team and they might do that when there's enough people to make that a thing. But realistically, they know that my KPIs come from driving YouTube traffic, which is going well. And I prefer YouTube way over Twitch because it's just way more like labor intensively better for me, because I can just like film, say, 10 YouTube videos in a day and then slow release them. I'm a little bit lacking at the moment, but that's the plan anyway, to try and get that into a bit more of a schedule, post a schedule for releasing videos and try and release like 3 videos a week. That seems to be like the GTO way to do it, but easier said than done. They pay me X.
No, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
But a lot of that goes towards like my editors and sort of the costs that come with like running some of that stuff. I do net a little bit from that. And then they pay me a percentage of the affiliates that sign up through me. And then if I come up with like crazy project ideas and they like them, they'll fund them. But it's obviously case dependent. But what I liked about the deal was obviously, great, it funds my growth. Because realistically, if I get to say 100,000 subs on YouTube, like, I can command a pretty hefty sponsorship deal once I get to that point. So if they're funding me to get to that stage, then sick. So that's kind of cool, because that kind of gives me a natural kind of like, I can always make money at YouTube if I've got 100,000 subs. Because if you assume that like At the moment, I'm probably slightly losing on videos. I think they need about 30,000 views to break even. I'd say I'm averaging. I was averaging 15,000. That's slowly tricked up to like 18,000 now. So like I'm losing like say $30 a video, which is nothing really, because that builds people out some academies and I get paid by GG. So it all works itself out. But there's a tipping point where that's going to start making pretty decent money, and it's all exponential again as well. Where like if I get that to I like to think that I can get that to plus 30,000 this year, but like if we do get some exponential growth, then that's fantastic. But GG, they were the one people that approached me. Like if Stars had approached me, it could have been a different conversation, but they were very much like, they want to help me. Like I knew what I wanted and they were happy. Mm-hmm. They agreed basically to all my demands. And they really see poker as a growth market. They really see like them getting into America. They see themselves breaking into countries that don't currently have regulations. And I think that Stars are a bit more handcuffed by the fact that they're owned by Amaya, where they can't rock the boat because their sports betting side is so much bigger than their poker side that they can't afford to lose that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, even though I'm fairly critical towards what happened in the past with GG Poker, and the people who are watching my channel know that, what I have to say, though, is that I've been talking about a few people that worked with them, is that they understand the perspective from the streamer / YouTuber side pretty well. So they understand your agenda, if we want to call it so, better than most businesses that are out there in poker. And I think that's really important, that they understand that you have ambitions as well yourself in terms of growth. And then, you know, if they can do something, you know, which is sometimes fairly cheap for them to basically help you, then they're going to more likely do that. And that is, I think, something that poker sites in general have to be aware of, how they position their ambassadors. The positioning of them is really, really important, because it's kind of a win-win situation. If they win, if the ambassadors win, the poker side wins. And that's really critical.
That's how GG see it. They're very much like, if you grow, we grow. So we just want to fund your growth. And I'm like, well, okay, sounds good to me. And like, you know, if I want a cameraman to go around Vegas with me, they're like, all right. And I'm like, okay. Really? I'm like,
sure. But that's sometimes not so easy to find, you know, especially someone who does it well, right? If you want to say, I go to Vegas for 4 weeks.
Had a cameraman. Mm-hmm. We actually had a cameraman for our Ginger Poker Adventure stuff, and we hired a student, and I'm like, okay, we had to basically burn all that footage, man. It was so disappointing to come away from like a 4-day filming and basically only be able to use GoPro footage, which is really, really annoying. But it's one of those things that like, it was like an experimental first draft with all the Ginger Poker Adventures, and we know what we did right and know what we did wrong. And now it's kind of like, okay, we need to go do it again and fix all these mistakes now that we've learned from them.
Yeah, just that the quality in the end, the output is really good. And it's actually, you know, and I think there it's also in terms of what people are worth doing that kind of thing for you. It's sometimes also exponential, right? You know, someone who's just basic knowledge might be not worth much at all. And they kind of don't see that way, because if we, like, let's say you kind of learned how to handle a camera a little bit, and then you said, well, yeah, I would like to be paid this much. And in reality, like, actually not worth that much, because you still need that experience to be, you know, doing that kind of work. You know, you still need to become better, and then your worth goes up. And then of course you can be hired by more and more people, whether it's in poker or like outside of it. But oftentimes it needs years to become really good at these skills. And, you know, you probably know this as well, like making YouTube videos, there's so many skills. You just have to outsource some of them. It's so hard to be good at,
definitely.
At telling a story, at the editing, at the content itself that you're trying to present. There's just so much behind it, and the whole graphics, etc. There's so much work, and oftentimes, as you say, it's actually not profitable at first, unless you have like it's subsidized by an academy or some coaching or something like that. Oftentimes, that's why a lot of people focus on playing itself and not try to grow a brand, because it's actually hard. I think it's a lot harder than people think it is.
Yeah, and I'm lucky that the audience kind of just came with me, and I've been like, oh, I've got an audience now, what do I do? As opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, that you have to kind of grow it, you know. But you know, that's what I'm also always saying a lot, is like, people don't see what the story behind, right? Like, you had a lot of years leading up to what's happening today. There's a lot of years behind that. And that's where the long-term AV was created. It wasn't now or the last year where you made those videos. It was all that you kind of had to gather the story.
It's like the first million is the hardest one to make, but the second one's easier.
Yeah, and people sometimes just see the tip of the iceberg and everything below it, that they just forget about it. You need to sometimes have half a decade leading up to these things, and it doesn't just happen like that. These stories, that's just how it is.
I had an interesting conversation with Pads, and he said to me, "Do you not find that people are very like super try hard to become like poker ambassadors?" And I was like, I don't know. I don't really like pay attention that much to poker ambassadors. I've always just been doing my own thing and not really like, oh, I wonder what that guy's doing. I wonder what this guy's doing. Like, yeah, I'm aware of some of like the streamers or some of the other YouTubers or whatever, but it's not really. But then as soon as he said it, I've just noticed more and more of it. Like, it's like one of those things that like, someone notices something and then you can't stop but see it. And I would just see all these, sometimes they tag me and like, oh, can you promote my Twitch? I'm like, that's.
Oh, you get a lot of that.
I'm starting to get a lot more, and I'm just like, I don't really know how to answer this, because I know that you're like gonna not be happy with me if I say no, but I don't really want to do this.
It's
a bit weird.
I think in terms of collaborations, just like this one, I think it's like, is it going to be win-win? You know, it's like, you know, maybe you have an hour, 2 hours of podcast, and like, is it going to be valuable for both parties? And sometimes the answer is just no, not yet, or maybe also not in the future, but I think a lot of people they don't see, or they also overestimate what they bring to the table.
I think so.
And they should reflect on how they can actually get better first, and then they will provide enough value, right? And like
it's a bit weird for me to go, oh, come back when you've got 100 viewers. that seems so horrible a thing to say, but I don't know. It's just one of those like, well, if I just keep spamming all my audience with all this, it's just gonna dilute me.
It is, you know, it's a hard thing to say, but sometimes it's also the truth. You know, I don't want to discourage anyone starting out, but if you're just starting out with poker, then document that, you know, it's like follow people who tell you about like how to document your journey. Like people, you know, will look back on the moments where you started out and you had no audience. And, you know, to make also it a little bit more encouraging to people who are trying that, that people will see that, how you, you know, even with zero viewers, still had some enjoyment, because if you're not, that's just not for you. Like if you're not enjoying it, having your first few viewers, and if you're not like excited about it, like do something else or change the platform. Like for me, I think making YouTube content is a lot more exciting than for example, grinding on Twitch, because I know that with streaming Podlimidoma, I have such a niche, like there's so many bigger streams out there. Like it's not a discoverability platform to begin with, I think. Also, Gary V said that multiple times. So I don't see a point of showing up there, you know, unless like it's once in a while. But I'm certainly not going to grind it out there. Try to be someone I'm not, you know.
Yep. Yeah, it makes sense.
Doesn't make too much sense to me.
YouTube just makes way more sense to me as well. Even as someone that is a streamer.
Yeah. Yeah, because you just get to. You know, the audience finds you, right? It's not like you find them. They find you. If they're interested, they're interested. If they're not, then they don't want to. You got to make the content better. And it's also something that I try to do in the future, especially past COVID, because I think the live poker scene, I don't know how you're looking forward to that with that. You mentioned it with, you know, potential locks with the WCOP coming up. You're trying to get in there. That's certainly something that I thought about as well, whether I want, if I can find the right people to work with, that's also something that I find cool. But then, you know, I want to still be playing well. I don't want to, you know, make it all like a charade where you just talk about the poker journey and it's like all about the content and you're just playing for the lulz. Now I want to play well and do well
really tough to find that balance, because obviously there's in poker now you've got a difference between like someone who's good at poker and someone that's like, I'm not good at poker, but here's my journey. And it seems to be a bit of a either or. And, you know, I think don't overthink it too much. Like if I do it, I'm just gonna be like, right, not really sure what I'm gonna do today. Go check out the games here, and here, and then explain why I hate the Bellagio, because you gotta bribe your way into the game. And and tell them that's why I'm playing the win, and then maybe ask them if I can, whatever, put the camera on the table for some of the hands, and then, I don't know, figure it out from there. Talk about if I'm going to play an event or what I'm up to that day. And it's more like a diary as opposed to a...
It shouldn't feel like... It shouldn't feel like too much work, right? It especially when you're playing for 8 hours a day, sometimes 10, 12 hours in tournaments, like you can't be bothered with like putting in another full session of like,
I've got to go and document this now.
Like if you want to pay somebody, you actually want that person like comes up with his own ideas, at least on how to make things look. And then that's going to be a lot of value, right? And that's actually the people you want to work with, I think.
Yeah, I like the way Daniel Bryan does it, where he like does all the footage in the day and then you get it the next day. I feel like that's super cool. Would that be pretty labor intensive and maybe fairly expensive? But I think it's a really cool way. I think it's a really cool way to get people to follow along, though.
I think he does it really well. Yeah. I mean, with the whole WCP vlogs and then journey where he just has like every day and he has someone making these highlight videos. It's obviously a lot, you know, also very expensive, but. But it is certainly going to be the kind of content I think that you want to be rolling out. Yeah, where do you see yourself in a few years? Like,
it's another question that I've been thinking about, and I'm still thinking about it. Everyone keeps it's funny. I've been asked this question a few times this week, and I'm like, I don't know. It's interesting because. I'm still working on myself in so many different ways, physically probably being the main one that I'm more focused on now, because that's just like something to do. Even with the lockdown, I can go and do exercise, and I'm trying to keep up on top of that, because that's something that I definitely didn't do in my latter years that I want to make sure I'm on top of. Poker wise, I want to stay sharp. I want to be able to compete, but whether that's me long term, I don't know. And I'm kind of looking for what the next thing is in terms of like, I've got all my ducks in a row with everything that I'm doing, like in terms of like, I've got my sponsorship, I've got my academy, I've got my, you know, if I've got my health in line, then it's going to be, all right, what's next for me in terms of like, where do I want to live full time? Like, but I can't really do anything about that till COVID finishes, making sure my money's working for me in terms of investments, or whether I invest in some sort of like financial education, so I'm a little bit sharper that way, just kind of like sharpen those things up. And then like, but even that is just kind of like passing the ball down to what I actually want to do in the future. It's kind of like, well, why are you doing all this? What do you actually want to do for? And I still haven't quite figured that out. And that's something that I'm going to think about for the next week and hopefully have an answer for you, but I don't quite have one now.
What about, I mean, we didn't talk about it, but I sometimes ask progress out there, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but what about dating? Like and family?
Yeah, let's talk about
that. Is that something?
That's actually something that I've been on my mind recently as well. So in terms of dating for me, my last serious girlfriend was probably the end of university. And that was, would have finished in like 2012. So to context for people watching this in 10 years, it's 2021 now. It's
a long time.
And So have you ever seen the film Whiplash?
No. What was it about?
Right. I highly, highly, highly recommend it to everyone watching this. It's about a drummer who goes to a music school and gets like a really harsh teacher. And the teacher's like, the idea of the movie being that he's being super harsh to get the best out of him, but like it's a bit of a conflict all the way through. But it's a fantastic film, won an Oscar, it's incredible. But anyway, my girlfriend basically said to me or poker, and this wasn't even when I was a full-time player, but my decision to break up with her wasn't because it would have always been her, but because she made me choose, it was like, well, I can't really, like, because right after you finish university, like, you've got all these kind of like, what am I going to do next? Am I going to go work here? Am I going to go do this? Am I going to do that? And if you're already like limiting my decisions without even like this, how is that going to, you know, am I just going to wake up miserable at the age of 30 regretting anything? Like, and I don't
that you really haven't done it. Yeah.
So for me, that was like, okay, sorry, regardless of the fact that I would have picked you, I can't do this. And so similar to in Whiplash, he breaks up with his girlfriend because he's like, look, I want to be a professional drummer. Like, well, I'm not going to be able to spend time with you. We're going to spend less and less time together. You're going to get annoyed at me because I can't spend time with you, and I'm just going to focus on drumming, and then you're going to hate me anyway, so we might as well break up now. I felt like, for me, poker was like that for a while, where I was just like so focused on poker to the point where I couldn't have a relationship. I wasn't open to a relationship. I wasn't there for it. I wasn't like emotionally connected enough. And maybe that's just been like habits. And you can have fairly, you know, I've had a lot of my friends call them 3-day relationships, where I'm like, all right, you've had your time, now I'm done. And and it's it's becoming a bit more of a pattern than I'd like it to be, especially as I'm getting like to the age, like I'll be 30 this year. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about this for a while. And for a long time, I was like, well, I don't really, I was, when I was still struggling as a poker player, I really struggled to tell girls that I was a poker player. And I felt, and this may be my perception, it may be wrong, that they saw poker as, oh, that's really cool. And it'd be cool for a few seconds. And then it'd be like, it's not really stable long-term. So you're not really like a good like fit as a partner. So I wasn't financially secure at the time. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a poker player. I'm not doing this real job. I'm just gambling. And like, I can see very quickly how they could perceive that as a negative. And maybe I read into that more than there was actually there, but that was definitely something that held me back for a while. And then, so then I got to a stage where I was financially secure. And then I was like, well, what's actually holding me back now? Like what's stopping me from being like emotionally wanting to get into a relationship? And then I had a long think about this and I was like, what it is, if that's a sentence, what it is that I feel that I want to get the best partner I can. Because let's assume you only get one or you only want one. And then for me to get the best partner I can, I have to be the best version of myself that I can be. So for a long time, there's like all these things that I was trying to fix, like, you know, my weight, my personality, my financial security. And then it just hit me one day. I was like, well, realistically, there's always going to be something you're going to need to fix. Like you can never be the best version of yourself. And like you can strive to be that and that's great. But realistically, that it's starting to aim for perfection, which you can never get to. And that's what I've started to realize over the last year or so. And I'm not, I don't know. So now I'm still sort of thinking over this and trying to figure it out. And I'm sure the right person, if it came along, will come along. I'm way more emotionally open to that. So I've kind of had a few relationships that have been like semi-serious recently, but it's not easy. Like when you kind of like, you've got a lot of, and I don't want to sound sexist or arrogant or any way, but when you kind of like, you're looking for someone that's going to like, you know, be part of the team. That's like the best way to put it. Like you want someone that's going to embrace your lifestyle, and it's not a conventional lifestyle. It's not a, you know, a lot of people are in this 9-to-5. A lot of people are in this, live in the same country. And it's difficult to go from like, oh, I want to go do this for a few months. And they're like, well, I'm quite happy here. Or it's like, you're too early in the relationship to say, oh, I'll pay for everything, because that's not quite, you know, people aren't necessarily on the same level financially. It's like, there's a lot of maybe there are hurdles that I'm creating for myself, but like there are a lot of things that I'm trying to basically figure out what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with. I'm still trying to figure it out. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on anything I've said.
Yeah, actually I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I'm also not quite sure about them yet, because there's a lot of elements that you just mentioned that are true for me as well, because I've gotten more stable financially over the last few years as well. And also things like in terms of, okay, what do both bring to the table? What I'm actually really looking for in terms of a woman these days. And it's also hard, like, what do you tell them at the beginning? Do you tell them, hey, what kind of picture do you want to draw for them? Do you want to say, hey, I actually gamble a lot and I'm actually quite good at it? You know, it's like, take it or leave it, you know, this is just how it is. And that's like the first part. And then all these other elements of improving yourself, you know, there's certain things that I certainly don't like about, you know, how I was in my 20s. And a lot of it was like, actually, I was surprised by some of the naivete that I had in my 20s sometimes. I was just too trusting with something, you know, getting scammed left and right, and just don't really see other people for how they are. I was projecting way too much on them of my own values, thinking like, you know, I would be honest in this spot. Like, I think that person would be honest too. And it's like, no, this is just not how the shit works, you know. They're going to absolutely lay out stuff in other directions. And it's like, this is one of the things that I also try to work on, like seeing things as they are and like communicating very, very clearly of what you want and being very authentic and like even trying hard to be authentic and not just, you know, try to... make it like sound well or something. I'd be like more direct. And like as a Swiss person, I think a lot of Swiss people are like that. We're very direct. Indirect.
Indirect.
German, direct. The German people, they're very direct.
But you're a little bit too neutral.
It's like, too neutral. We're like always like, let's make this work. And like not diplomatic, right? And like, that is something that I want to stop being a little bit, because like being diplomatic sometimes is good, but it also leads to a lot of problems. Just because you're not... Yeah, as well. Like long term, it just doesn't work out that way sometimes. And in terms of dating, I was dating until like 3.5 years ago. I was also first it was a long distance relationship, and then we moved in together here in Austria. And then in the end, also broke up with her because I just didn't see that common future. Right, like just different beliefs about the future, I think. And it just, you know, yeah, it was a very, very difficult one. And also with self-development, there's also something very toxic about it too, because there's somebody earning at the other side of it. And I think it's going to be a prime reason why some people make self-development content as well. And that's really, really bad. I think there's a need in self-development of how you can become the best version of yourself to be like honest and not just about the money of like trying to upsell you into, you know, insanely sick paid masterminds, which sometimes don't really bring any value. There's a lot of like with the internet development in the last few years, like I've observed this thing for a very long time. There's a lot of high ticket sales and stuff, which I don't subject to at all. I really want, like, if you sell something, like please provide value and not try to make it, you know, there's almost this, like this high ticket sales is all about, I dare you can't afford me. And then you throw it at as many people as possible.
It's definitely a thing, right? It's definitely a thing where you see it like, and you're like, oh.
You know, it's like, I dare you can't afford me. And then, you know, you'll always find some idiots in quotes who will try to prove you otherwise. That's like what it's all about, in my opinion. And I really hate that part because in the end, for me, it's like, try to go for win-win as much as possible when you work with people. And that's like my prime thing. What in whatever relationship it is, whether it's romantic or other relationships. And like cut the ones that are actually not win-win and like let other people actually cut it with you if you're not win-win with them. Like always like, is this a win for you? Like if it's not, just let's end this because this doesn't make any sense if it's not win-win.
It's tough. I think you touched on something that I resonate with, which is the always bearing yourself kind of like there's no end game. And the way I've tried to like reason that in my head is I try to see things as finite games or infinite games, like, and I try and realize which one I'm playing. And if I'm playing an infinite game, I have to realize I'm playing an infinite game and realizing that I can't win an infinite game. And then to like either stop playing or accept that. And I think with this bettering yourself thing, I realized that I was playing an infinite game. I was like, oh, well, there's no end to this. And once I realized that, and there's a lot of situations that happens with in like real life, there's a really cool motivational speaker called Simon Sinek.
I heard that off the Infinite Game.
I really liked his explanation of that. Just in case anyone else hasn't heard it, a quick anecdote from it was he talked about Apple versus Microsoft, and he says Apple's playing an infinite game; it's just trying to make the best product for its customers, and Microsoft's playing a finite game where it's just trying to beat Apple. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between how those games are played and which one's just trying to be in business for the longest and which one's just trying to catch up or whatever. And I think those kind of games occur all the time in real life. And I think if you don't recognize them, you can get lost sometimes playing infinite games. And sometimes that's not the right thing to be doing.
Yeah.
But for me, dating was certainly something that I was less open to. And I've become more open to it, but I'm still not quite there yet. I like to think that if the right person came, I'd be open to it. But it's just, it hasn't happened yet. And I'm just questioning whether that's me not being open to it enough. And I'm still trying to figure that out.
And then with the whole pandemic situation as well, like you have to ask yourself, do you actually put yourself in a spot where you meeting these women that you would be attracted to with their lifestyles, et cetera, and vice versa? Like if you don't, then you just don't, right?
Yeah,
that is quite a bit of a concern as well. Like for me, like I've always told like some of my friends like who thought that lockdowns, etc., are not as problematic, like they're because of how their lives are organized. Maybe they have someone in the last area in a relationship and their jobs just continue the normal way they are. Whereas they don't see like if this was true for 4 or 5 years, I would totally not be in it. This is not going to be like a game that I will play like for 5 years for no reason. It's like trashing away my early 30s, which, you know, I think could be really important for somebody that I want in the future, a relationship, right? So that is certainly something that I'm not want to take part of. And then that's a little bit political also. But yeah, that's something I thought about for the last few months quite a bit too. You know, what the effects are of this whole pandemic. And
we're not really going to be able to see all of that come to fruition for years and years, and then it's just going to be like, oh, we'll fuck that up.
Yeah. Anyway, I also want to ask you, who do you think would be, do you know anyone who would make a great fit for this podcast here?
Good question. Pads is fantastic. I really enjoy interviewing Pads. Are you talking poker specifically?
I mostly have poker people and poker life and industry and what their different perspectives are. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Pads is a really good shout. I don't know, because I haven't really done that many podcasts. So it's I don't know, other than Pads is the first name that came off the top of my head. I can't think of anyone else. Maybe Gazzy B or maybe Ben Abadbeat. I need to have a good chat with Ben Abadbeat. Not sure how many podcasts he has time for these days, because he's obviously got a lot of his mental game clients too. He does a lot of work with, I'm sure. But anyone in the Zoom poker cash streets can't be a bad shout.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. So, anything else that you want to share with the audience, and where can people find you?
Ginge Poker on everything, especially YouTube. That's the one. Please subscribe to YouTube. That's my main one that I care about. If you want to see things that I don't post on YouTube, probably Instagram's better. Twitch every now and again, but not more sporadically, especially now that I'm playing some of the high stakes stuff. It's just when the game runs and if I feel like I'm sharp enough to stream and play super high stakes. Nothing more to add really, other than thank you for having me. Great host, and I hope that some of that stuff that we spoke about was interesting to the viewers. And if they've got any questions, I'll happily have a look at the comments and fire off if anyone's got anything for me.
Yeah, for everyone who's listening here or listening later to the audio version of this, you can find the links that Ginge just mentioned in the description below, so you can follow him. And yeah, thanks a lot for being my guest today, Richard. It was my pleasure to have you as my guest, and hope you have a good one.
Thank you. All right.